Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's conversation is one that I believe many of you will feel quite hopeful at the end of it. The intent, as you know, of each Mind Talk conversation is the expansion of your mental health literacy awareness, and today's conversation is another entry for your expanded consideration. You stay where you are. We'll be right back. We are back. This is Pamela Brewer, and today's guest is Dr. Larry Birkelhammer. And Dr. Birkelhammer is the author of In Your Own Hands, New Hope for People with Chronic Medical Conditions. And Dr. Birkelhammer talks about a mindfulness-based practice for mastery and well-being. So we will talk about that when we talk with Dr. Birkelhammer in just a moment. His book has been described as accomplishing what few other books on the topic of chronic illness do. It proposes a fundamentally optimistic approach towards change that reestablishes a life of meaning. It has also been described as an exceptional book about the healing power of our minds when used in conjunction with self-management of chronic disease. Dr. Larry Birkelhammer, welcome to Mind Talk, and thank you for writing this book.
Well, thank you for having me. I wrote the book in the hopes that it would help people. I wrote about methods that helped me, and I've been finding that they've been very useful to other people, so that pleases me immensely.
Well, you know, Mind Talk is really about mental and relationship health literacy. And so at first blush, when I was told about the book, I heard chronic pain management, and I assumed, without looking at it, that it was about medications and pills and surgeries and things and exercises, physical exercises and things of that nature. But when I actually got a hold of the book and saw that you were really focusing on a mindfulness-based practice, it was really quite intriguing. Let's start with what you actually mean when you say a mindfulness-based practice for mastery and well-being.
I'm probably like most people. I spend most of my time thinking about what has already happened or what hasn't yet happened. I think about, that thing I said to that person yesterday, I wish I had said it differently, or something that happened 10 years ago, I wish that had been different. I just keep playing things over and over in my mind, and it causes a lot of stress, and it's unnecessary stress because whatever happened in the past isn't happening anymore. And we do the same with the future. You know, we're always planning. Seems to be human nature to always be planning. And, of course, it's important to be able to plan, because if we don't plan, then we end up in places we don't intend to be.
Right.
And we end up doing things that we don't intend to do. So planning is important. The problem is we carry it all a little bit too far.
When you say carry it too far, what do you mean?
So there are people in the world, not very many, but there are a few people in the world who are actually able to go through their entire day being fully present, with fully experiencing their moment-to-moment experience. And that's mindfulness. And you can learn to practice that. And once you practice it, the more you practice it, the more present you become. And the beauty of being present is, think of the last time you were in one of your favorite restaurants, having one of your favorite meals, and you were with other people. You get so busy talking that you don't fully appreciate the meal, where our attention is spread too thin. And the same is true in practically every activity. So we can learn through mindfulness practice to be fully in our current moment experience. And this has a lot to do with how happy we are, and how happy we are has a lot to do with our level of health. For example, I live with chronic pain. Mm-hmm. Now, the more I think about getting rid of the pain, the more my attention is actually on the pain.
Right.
And so the way to have less pain is not to be thinking about getting rid of the pain. The way to have less pain is to more fully experience whatever we are doing from moment to moment. And you could call that distraction. We're distracting ourselves from the pain. Distraction works. But that's not mindfulness. It's effective, and I recommend it. But I also recommend mindfulness, which is just paying full attention to whatever it is we are doing from moment to moment throughout the day.
Now,
and in that way, we can live a more full life.
You know, for those who are listening and they've heard me share the name of your book, the subtitle, New Hope for People with Chronic Medical Conditions. So for many people, my thought is that chronic medical condition and mindfulness being in the moment, they're not quite feeling that one. If you've got a chronic medical condition, if you're living, for example, with chronic pain, why would you want to be in the moment? You're saying that there is actually value to being in the moment. So talk about that a little bit more, if you will.
Yeah. So if I'm feeling pain and I think about getting rid of the pain, you might say, well, that's being in the moment because I'm feeling the pain that I'm feeling in this moment. So therefore, if I'm feeling what I'm experiencing in this moment, then I'm in the moment, and that's mindfulness. However, that does not reduce the pain. That actually exacerbates and amplifies the pain.
I would think so.
Yeah. However, if I'm with a group of friends and I'm feeling pain, if I focus all my attention on the conversation with my friends, then I have less attention to focus on my pain. And I'm fully present. I'm fully present in the conversation, enjoying myself because I'm enjoying being with my friends, and feeling less pain because I'm fully present with something that's a lot more pleasant than being fully present with the pain.
You begin your book with saying that at the age of 54, was when you finally received correct diagnoses for multiple chronic conditions you'd been living with, some of them since childhood. And you say that you had six different chronic illnesses.
Sometimes people ask me, oh, what do you have? And I start to tell them, and I realize afterwards, oh, I left a couple out. It's hard to remember.
That seems overwhelming just to think about that.
There are people much worse off than I am. And whenever I start to feel sorry for myself, I see someone in a wheelchair. I might see a quadriplegic. And then I realize, boy, that puts things in perspective. And it gives me such great appreciation for what I have. I can look around at people my same age who are out mountain biking, and which is a big sport where I live in Northern California, or they're surfing, or they're playing singles tennis, or they're... I have a friend who still, at the age of 68, is playing baseball. And I have someone else I know who, at 69, is still playing full-court basketball with people young enough to be his grandchildren. And so it's very easy to get envious of those people, and then going into, oh, woe is me, poor me. But that only makes things much, much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so mindfulness is really about, it's not just about meditation, it's about practicing, having a gratitude practice. So, for example, identifying what's working in my life, what's going on in my life that I have appreciation for, and to then actually have a time set aside on a regular basis. Could be every day, could be once a week. Some studies have shown once a week is perfectly good, where I actually keep a journal of all the things that are going well, all the things for which I have great appreciation in my life. And, you know, one of the things that happens with depression is going over and over all the things that aren't going well.
Exactly.
So by practicing going over in our minds all the things that are going well, we actually get much happier. And as we get happier, we feel less pain. There are fewer stress hormones being secreted throughout the body. Stress hormones are necessary, but they also can increase pain, and depending on the situation.
Sure.
And so focusing on what's good, now I don't mean being Pollyanna.
Right.
It's important to be realistic. It's important, for example, if you have chest pain, that's not the time to be Pollyanna.
Exactly.
That's the time to maybe dial 911.
Right.
Or possibly to pop a couple of antacids, and if the pain goes away, it's probably nothing to worry about. But if you're feeling chest pain and you pop a few antacids and the pain doesn't diminish at all, that's maybe a good time, instead of being Pollyannish, to dial 911. So it's important to know when, you know, when to think positively and when to be realistic.
Well, and it sounds like even in the positive thinking, you're talking about realism. I mean, you know, if you're in chronic pain and you're out with your friends at a restaurant and you can shift the focus slightly to engage, as you describe, fully with that moment and those people and that restaurant and the surroundings, then you actually are being very realistic because you're really paying attention to what's really happening in front of you at that moment.
That's exactly right. And you're focusing on the positive. You're
exactly.
not focusing on the pain. You're focusing on the positive. And yet at the same time, you're very much in touch with reality, with what's happening in the moment, practicing mindfulness. A lot of people think, oh, mindfulness is when you're sitting doing some Buddhist meditation practice.
Right.
Well, that is a practice that cultivates mindfulness. But true mindfulness goes on all day long. It's not just when you're meditating. In fact, there have been some well-known people, the name Krishnamurti comes to mind, who didn't even advocate formal meditation. He made fun of formal meditation because he said, mindfulness is not this thing you do during these isolated periods of the day during this private meditation period. Mindfulness is about just living your life fully alive, fully present to your moment-to-moment experience, and that mindfulness meditation isn't necessary at all.
You know, it's interesting. There's mindfulness nowadays is almost the every other word that comes out of somebody's mouth if they're talking about feeling well and healthy. And yet we live in a society that, in fact, encourages us so much to be anything but mindful. I mean, I think about all the distractions that we have around us, and it's pretty amazing. Dr. Birkelhammer, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, you indicated that you actually had six illnesses, and I'm going to ask you just to let folks know what kinds of things you're dealing with as you and I continue in our conversation.
Sure.
I want the listeners to be aware of, you know, what your own experience is. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I am having a conversation with Dr. Larry Birkelhammer, who is the author of In Your Own Hands, New Hope for People with Chronic Medical Conditions. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Dr. Berkelhammer, you have written a book to help folks navigate chronic medical conditions. What are the medical conditions that you deal with on a regular basis?
Yeah. So one of the things that I have is called ITP. It's an autoimmune disease. It's where the immune system mistakes platelets for foreign, and so it attacks them.
Hmm.
That's how all autoimmune diseases work. That's one of hundreds and hundreds of different autoimmune diseases. Fortunately, I don't have hundreds. I also have a primary immunodeficiency condition, and some people are much worse off than I am. Most people have heard of what used to be known as the bubble boy syndrome, which is severe combined immunodeficiency, where you don't have enough B cells, you don't have enough T cells, CD4s, CD8s, deficient in all of that. I have a mild form of severe combined immunodeficiency, so it's not called that,
mm-hmm.
but it's a primary combined immunodeficiency. And so that can predispose me to all kinds of problems that would normally be taken care of by the immune system. I also have very severe osteoporosis,
mm.
way more severe than you would find in very many 95-year-old osteoporotic women.
Huh.
And it's extremely unusual for it to be so severe in a man my age. But what happened was, one of the other things I have is a lifelong malabsorption syndrome. So I, throughout my life, have not been absorbing all the nutrients in food.
Hmm.
And so if you're not absorbing calcium, I used to eat a diet rich in, I used to eat a lot of yogurt and cheese,
mm-hmm.
and other foods that had a lot of dairy, a lot of high calcium content. The problem is, I probably wasn't absorbing the calcium.
Okay.
Even though I was eating a lot of dairy products and engaging in a lot of weight-bearing exercise, I continued to develop severe osteoporosis simply because
uh-huh.
I wasn't absorbing the nutrients that I needed.
Gotcha.
I also have mitral valve regurgitation. The mitral valve is the valve that pumps the blood from the left atrium to the left ventricle of the heart. And my mitral valve is floppy, so some of the blood regurgitates back into the atrium of the heart.
Hmm.
I also have had a couple of episodes of atrial fibrillation, but I'm not in it all the time. I have preventricular and preatrial contractions of my heart, so it's an odd beat. In about 15 years ago, it was believed I had something called ankylosing spondylitis, which is a degenerative spine condition that also affects the hips. And it turned out they now believe I didn't have that because I recovered.
Okay.
For the most part. I recovered about 90%. And people with ankylosing spondylitis don't recover.
I see.
So they now think it was an inflammatory form of arthritis, which for the most part recovered. But I still live with quite a bit of back pain, spine pain, hip pain, and pain in joints throughout my body, knees, feet, everywhere.
So for somebody listening, to as you give this list, I mean, it just sounds like life would be physically very difficult for you. And then, of course, it also sounds like you would be a great candidate for depression more often than not.
I got depressed at one time because I grew up believing that, I was in high school when Kennedy was president, and it was a very idealistic time. Even all the 50s was very idealistic. And so I grew up believing that medicine will soon be able to cure everything.
Mm-hmm.
And about 15 years ago, when I started getting diagnosed with these things, and one after another, I was given diagnoses, and immediately upon being given diagnosis, I was also told, but you know, we don't have a cure for this yet.
Mm-hmm.
And no cure for this, no cure for that, no cure for this, no cures for anything. Turns out, about the only thing that is cured, very few things are cured. We have antibiotics that can cure bacterial infections. We have antivirals that can sometimes cure some viral infections. We have a few other cures out there, but for the most part, when things go wrong, they remove the damaged or infected or malfunctioning organ. That's not a cure. Or they give us medications that that can reduce the symptoms.
Right.
But reducing the symptoms is not the same as curing the disease.
Right. And in fact, you quote the Center for Disease Control as saying that at least 122 million Americans live with some form of chronic illness. Medication is not going to cure what's going on.
That's right. And with the aging population, that's just going to keep increasing more and more as baby boomers move into their 70s and 80s. Those numbers are only going to increase.
So here we have a huge number of people who are walking and living with any number of chronic illnesses. Would you say that your diagnostic picture is extremely different from other people with chronic illnesses, or would you say that most people with chronic illnesses have more than one thing going on?
Well, mine is different from the norm in that most people with chronic illness have illnesses that are the result of unhealthy lifestyles.
Okay.
You can see the obesity epidemic, which is also referred to as diabesity, which is, I'm not talking about type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease. I'm talking about type 2.
And
heart disease, much of the heart disease out there is also the result of not getting enough daily exercise, not eating the right foods, eating the wrong foods. So there are those people, and those are the majority, but there are still large numbers of us who live with chronic illness who are doing everything right. There are many, many thousands of people out there like me who are living with debilitating chronic illness who took excellent care of themselves their whole lives, and were just the luck of the draw for either bad genetics. They may have inherited something from their parents or through some environmental exposure, were diagnosed with an autoimmune disease or some other debilitating condition. And so for those people are more likely to want to do and are more willing to do whatever it takes to get better. There are a lot of people who really would rather just continue eating all the, living on eating fattening foods and pastries and not exercising, and that's fine. That's their choice. But I write and teach for the people who are like me, who are living with debilitating chronic illness, who are willing, just want to be taught, tell me what to do, I'll do whatever it takes. Those are the people I write for and teach in my classes.
Now, you have used the word debilitating with autoimmune disease frequently in our conversation today. Are you saying that it's a given that if you have an autoimmune disease, it is debilitating? Are you saying that debilitating diseases can be positively impacted upon by mindfulness practice?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, there are some autoimmune diseases that are very mild and don't really impact significantly on anyone's life. But there are other autoimmune diseases that can totally destroy quality of life. However, even in those people, there's a lot they can do. And so it's very important to put your diagnosis, put your condition in perspective.
Okay.
And to not give up all the things that that bring meaning and purpose into your life, all the things that you value. It's important to identify your personal life values and to live by those values. And a lot of people, upon being diagnosed, just put their lives on hold.
Mm-hmm.
And that only makes things worse. It makes the pain worse. It leads to serious depression. So the idea is to live as fully as possible. Now, obviously, I used to be a runner. I used to love to run. I ran partly for exercise, but I ran mostly because I loved the freedom. I used to run through the town forest. And I used to just love to run off trail. And I can't do that anymore.
Mm.
I was a ski racer. I used to ski competitively. Grew up in New England, and skiing was my sport, downhill skiing. I can't do that anymore. Used to play tennis, can't do that anymore.
Hmm.
In fact, people all recommended I take up swimming because they said swimming's a great sport. A great exercise because it takes the stress off your joints. Well, that may be true for a lot of people, but I had to quit swimming after a short period of time because I was in too much pain swimming.
Wow.
So I can walk. I can get plenty of exercise. I have an incline trainer, which is like a treadmill, but it goes up a steep incline.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. I can go on hikes. I can't climb the steep things I used to do. Can't run up and down mountains the way I did years ago, but I get out in nature. I have a cable cross pulley machine at home, which allows me to do lots of strength building for the
mm-hmm.
whole body and stretching. I do yoga exercises for stretching. So there's a lot I do, and there's a lot most people can do. Now,
mm-hmm.
obviously, if someone's quadriplegic, no, that's an exception.
Right.
But even paraplegics, there's still a lot they can do. And so it's important to not only continue to get exercise, but to the single most important thing that I teach a class at College of Marin here in Marin County, California.
Mm-hmm.
And I also teach a class at Whistle Stop Senior Center here in Marin. And the single thing I teach more than anything else is that it's important to take charge of your life. I tell people, you need to find good doctors. You need to have doctors you trust and follow their recommendations. But that's not enough. You need to be the one who's really in charge of your life.
Dr. Berkelhammer, I'm just going to interrupt you because we're going to take a break. But when we come back, what you're saying now sort of leads us into the next thing that I really wanted you to address, because you say that all medical conditions have in common the healing process is influenced by the state of mind. So
yes.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to pick up right there with the state of
Great.
Mind. Dr. Birkelhammer, at the risk of repeating myself, I'm going to repeat myself because what you say, I think, is so important to this entire conversation that we're having. So again, what you have said is that all medical conditions have one thing in common, and all medical conditions, and that is that the healing process is influenced by our state of mind. Please say more about that. That is a very powerful statement.
Yeah, I don't believe there is a disease known to man that isn't influenced by the state of mind. Now, the problem is people misinterpret that and they think, oh, are you saying I caused my illness? Well, every disease is influenced positively and negatively by our state of mind, but that doesn't mean that we cause the illness. It's just that if you have an illness, if you've been diagnosed, whether it's a form of cancer or one of the autoimmune diseases or anything, your state of mind will influence it. It's known that major depressive disorder is not good for health. It's known that anxiety disorders are not good for your health. Mental illness negatively impacts on physical health. Now, it works both ways, of course, but we can work with the mind. And in fact, we can do more with the mind than we can do with the body. Unfortunately, you know, people don't realize that medicine is really in its infancy. And as I said earlier, there are very few cures for anything yet. That's going to be changing over time, but for most people alive today, that's just the way it is. And what happened for me is I realized the doctors, medicine, they don't have the answers. Mm-hmm. So what about the mind? My background's in psychology, so I started thinking, well, you know, psychotherapists tend to work with issues, you know, psychological issues, emotional issues. You don't go to a psychotherapist for treatment of your physical condition. Right. But I've often said to psychotherapists, I think you're missing the boat, because psychotherapy can actually be a profoundly healing treatment for your physical condition, because anytime you improve your state of mind, you're going to improve your state of health. It doesn't mean you're going to be cured, but you will improve the odds. What happens is, when we're experiencing depression or anxiety or any mental illness or angst, there are increased stress hormones secreted in the body. And when that happens, that puts stress on the body. You know, every disease is influenced by stress. It's a physiologic stress, and physiologic stress is very strongly influenced by emotional distress. So any time we can reduce our level of emotional distress, we are going to reduce our physiological stress, our stress on the body. And any time we reduce the stress on the body, we are less likely to come down with a terrible disease. In fact, reducing our emotional distress, thereby reducing physiological or physical stress, actually makes it less likely we'll even catch a cold when we're exposed to someone with a cold virus.
Interesting.
So so this is what gives me hope, is the fact that there isn't a lot I can do physically. I can eat well, I can exercise, but beyond, I can get enough sleep. But beyond that, you know, take medicines that are prescribed for me. But there's a lot I can do with my mental state. So I highly recommend finding a good psychotherapist. I highly recommend any type of personal growth work that you can do, anything from journaling to going to workshops, because anything you can do to improve your state of mind will improve your state of health. Won't cure it in most cases, but it will improve it.
It'll improve it. Now, you say that Emotional stress and the untrained mind is the result of being out of harmony with our inner subjective experience of the moment. And so there's some people listening who are going to say, oh, that sounds like that New Age mumbo jumbo, which isn't even all that New Age anymore. What do you mean when you say being out of harmony with inner subjective experience?
Yeah. So I grew up in a family where there was I was constantly being put down and criticized for everything I said, everything I did, and even just for being me. Mm-hmm. And the end result of that was I ended up becoming totally numb and completely out of touch with my inner subjective being. In other words, I became completely out of touch with my thoughts and feelings. I had no clue. Mm-hmm. If someone asked, what are you feeling? I was sort of like someone with autism.
Or alexithymia.
Okay. I had no way of tuning into that. Mm-hmm. Because I had learned to tune that out. I had learned that I got shamed and scolded for just having a frown on my face. So I learned to become totally numb and oblivious to my thoughts and feelings, completely out of touch with my inner subjective experience. Mm. Objectively, I could tell you when I had pain, physical pain, or when I felt physically good in my body, when I was sick or well physically. But beyond that, there was no awareness of my inner subjective being. And that negatively impacted how I interacted with other people.
Sure.
It negatively impacted relationships, mm-hmm. negatively impacted my work life, everything. And gradually, I wish I could say you can do this in a short time, but gradually over the years of being in good psychotherapy, especially group psychotherapy, which is what I most highly recommend for people, although it's hard to find good group therapy.
It is.
I gradually learned that, you know, my feelings were getting validated. My thoughts were getting validated. And I began to allow myself to tune into my inner subjective experience. And the more I tuned into what was really going on inside, what really made me tick, the thoughts in my head, once I really allowed myself to objectively observe my thoughts, to objectively observe my feelings, my emotions, my sensations, my level of well-being, well-being is kind of a scientific term for happiness. Mm. My well-being or happiness began to dramatically increase and continues to increase to this day as I practice tuning in to my inner subjective experience.
So it sounds like what you're saying several things. One of them is that paying attention to one's emotional life and experiences is not only important because it's a nice thing to do, but it's critically important to your physical as well as your emotional well-being. It's critically important to your mental health to be able to tune into what's really going on with you.
It is. And, you know, one way mental illness is defined, mm-hmm. the inability mm-hmm. to access one's inner subjective being. Mm-hmm. The healthiest people I've ever met are people who are fully in touch with what they're thinking and feeling from moment to moment. But what happened to a lot of us, you know, I would notice a thought and then I would have a judgment. Oh, that's not a healthy thought. I shouldn't be having that thought. And as soon as I have the thought that I shouldn't be having this other thought, then I start to feel depressed.
Yeah.
And so it just spirals downhill by not owning my thoughts, by not accepting my thoughts, by not recognizing my feelings, my emotions, and not allowing myself to fully experience those, then I become totally out of touch with it, And, you know, these are the people you meet who always have the radio on, or they always have the TV on, or they're always texting or tweeting or on Facebook. They can't be alone with themselves. And, you know, they're just running from themselves, and they don't even know they're doing that. They think they're just running towards the people, their Facebook friends, and they're not even aware they're running from themselves. And this is a problem I see with social media. I think this has gotten a lot worse because of social media.
And, you know, the other thing, too, that I think about, you know, certainly men in this respect, I would suggest, got a really raw deal for a long period of time in that you were taught that you weren't supposed to have feelings, that was women's stuff, you know. It was like that frilly, frou-frou nonsense, and it had no meaning. And so, you know, socially, culturally, you were taught not to feel your feelings. And, you know, again, I think you guys, in that respect, I think you guys got a raw deal.
Yeah, men were supposed to be tough. Boys were supposed to be tough.
Right.
You know, you wouldn't often hear a girl called a crybaby, but boys would be called a crybaby as soon as one tear appears.
That's right.
If their eyes got red, they were called crybaby, and they were shamed for it. And, yeah, I grew up with that big time. I think that's improved a lot over the recent decades.
Yeah, I agree. You talk about things like cognitive fusion and experiential avoidance. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up with your conversation about cognitive fusion and the way in which we tend to confuse our thoughts and beliefs with reality, and how that impacts mindfulness and chronic illness. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back, and that's where we'll start. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening, and I really hope enjoying this conversation that I'm having with Larry Birkelhammer, Dr. Larry Birkelhammer, who is the author of In Your Own Hands, New Hope for People with Chronic Medical Conditions. We'll be right back. Dr. Birkelhammer, explain to us the concept of cognitive fusion as it relates to mindfulness practice and chronic medical illness.
Cognitive fusion, I believe the term was coined by okay, I'm having a senior moment here. psychologist Stephen Hayes. Mm. And Stephen Hayes is the one who was the primary driving force behind a new form of psychotherapy referred to as ACT, which stands for Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. So I think he was the one who founded the term cognitive fusion. But cognitive fusion, it could also be described as cognitive entanglement.
Okay.
Cognitive defusion would be disentangling or stepping back from your thoughts. So cognitive fusion is when you are not even aware of the thoughts you're having. you're behaving in a certain way mm-hmm. because you're unaware of the thought processes even going on in your head. Or maybe you've become aware of them, but you're completely powerless to change them. And so cognitive fusion is being fused with our thoughts, or entangled with them. And so there's a way to work with that. And the way to work with that is through mindfulness or acceptance and commitment therapy, although I should mention there are two other rapidly growing forms of psychotherapy that also incorporate the mindfulness approach. The most well-known one is DBT, which yeah. is dialectical behavior therapy.
Yeah.
It was originally designed to work with people with borderline personality disorder, mm-hmm. but it has now been found useful in other areas too. And then another form of psychotherapy using mindfulness and the same philosophy is MBCT, which is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. You know, back in the 50s, I'm blanking on his name. Okay, well, it was...
Not to worry, I'm not going to tell anybody.
Yeah, Aaron Beck was the person who really put cognitive therapy on
yeah,
the map.
Yeah.
And Albert Ellis, who's, mm-hmm. The one who put RBT or rationally motive behavioral therapy on the map. And so psychologist Albert Ellis and psychiatrist Aaron Beck taught us a new way of doing therapy where you could actually look at your thoughts and mm-hmm. then look at the evidence, identify whether the thought was a functional thought or a dysfunctional thought. In other words, did this thought process I'm having, does it help me live by my values and goals, or is it getting in the way? If it's getting in the way, it's a dysfunctional thought. And if it's helping me, it's a functional thought. And so cognitive therapy and rational emotive behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, as it later became, mixing behavioral and cognitive, became a way of looking at our thoughts, and if they were dysfunctional, we could restructure the thoughts, cognitive restructuring.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened in about 15 years ago, maybe in the 90s actually, blanking on her name, who invented dialectical behavior therapy, Marsha Linehan,
right?
Who was a Zen practitioner, mindfulness practitioner, started incorporating into her brilliant new form of psychotherapy. And then a few years later, Steve Hayes and others incorporated it into their new form of therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, we no longer have to work so hard at identifying dysfunctional thoughts versus functional thoughts, and then we don't no longer have to work so hard to disprove the dysfunctional thoughts, to look for evidence. There's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, most of the DBT and ACT therapists I know use a combination of methods. They
uh-huh.
also use cognitive behavioral.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a way of working where you identify the thought and you just allow, or the feeling, and you just allow yourself to be fully present with your thoughts and feelings, to develop acceptance for your thoughts and feelings, and to not try to change them, but to just be fully present with them. And the amazing thing, this is truly mind-blowing, that we always used to believe that if you have dysfunctional ways of thinking, you have to change that. And we now realize that just allowing ourselves to sit with it and to accept it and to fully experience our inner subjective being, our thoughts and feelings, things actually start to resolve just by allowing ourselves mm-hmm. to be with it. And this comes out of mindfulness. And this is why people like Jon Kabat-Zinn,
uh-huh.
who used to be he was originally a molecular biologist, a PhD in molecular biology, and he had a yoga practice and he had a Vipassana practice, a Zen practice, and then Vipassana, and he put it together and created something called mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's not a psychotherapy. It's for lay people. You just sign up for an 8-week class, and in this class you're taught how to meditate, and in meditating you're taught how to just sit with your feelings, follow your breath, follow the sensations of your breathing, not trying to do anything with the breathing, just following the physical sensations, and then noticing that your mind keeps wandering off to thoughts about the future, thoughts about the past, and to just notice where your mind goes, and without having any judgment about whether it's right or wrong, good or bad, just returning your full attention to the physical sensations of breathing. And there's even a form of mindfulness meditation where you actually let your attention drift away from the breath, and you get to a point where you're just watching your thoughts like clouds moving across the sky, but you're watching them without getting fused with them, without getting caught up or entangled with them. You're just dispassionately watching them as an objective observer would watch clouds floating across the sky. And once you're able to do that, that is a deep level of mindfulness practice, and it leads to dramatic reductions in emotional distress, which leads to dramatic reductions in physiologic stress, which improves health and improves well-being. And people, through living mindfully, begin to have a much greater appreciation for their ability to live with a full aliveness.
And I can also see that, you know, in terms of the chronic illness, if I'm going to sit, pain, for example, if I'm going to sit with, I have a pain, I'm always going to have a pain, I've always had the pain, not only am I not being in the moment, but I'm growing the pain. But if I can shift away from that to what's really happening right now, not trying to avoid the pain. I mean, you make the point that avoiding unpleasantries, you know, doesn't work. And that's why people try to avoid unpleasantries, because they think it'll make it go away, or magically it won't be a problem anymore, but it doesn't work. But so I am not avoiding the fact of having a pain, but I am allowing the rest of my life to come into focus, it sounds like, in that moment. Okay.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And, you know, it just seems like human nature, for all of us, that if we're feeling emotionally distraught or in physical pain, we want to get away from that. And we just want to make it go away. The problem is, the more we try to make it go away, the more we actually, you know, there's an expression, energy flows where attention goes. If we put our attention on our pain, we're going to have more pain.
Right.
If we put our attention on some stressing, distressful thought, feeling, if we try to make that go away, if we try not to think certain thoughts, then those thoughts are going to get magnified, and they're going to ruin our lives and run our lives. And so the secret seems to be to have acceptance for our inner subjective experience, have acceptance for whatever thoughts and feelings we are experiencing from moment to moment. And if we find ourselves being very self-critical, then we want to develop compassion around that. We want to develop self-compassion and say, oh, yeah, I'm having this, I'm beating myself up right now. I'm telling myself that I'm no good, that I don't measure up. I'm telling myself that I'm not lovable. All these awful things. You know, to develop acceptance and self-compassion. It's very easy to have compassion for someone else who's being self-critical. It's much harder to have self-compassion. It's harder to notice that we're even doing that. We can see it in someone else. We can see them beating themselves up. It's hard to see that we're doing it. We do it all the time. Most of us do it a lot.
You're absolutely right. I have to say, Dr. Birkelhammer, that the description that you're able to give us today as you and I talk, and the book that you have written, is really very hopeful and very helpful, I think, to a lot of folks, because clearly what you're saying is that if you are in pain right now, it doesn't have to be as painful and as debilitating as you are anticipating that it will be. Part of growing the pain is sitting in the anticipation of it. Clearly, there's lots more that we could talk about, but not today. Today, we are out of time. But again, I so much want to thank you for joining us and for your book, In Our Own Hands, New Hope for People with Chronic Medical Conditions, Mindfulness-Based Practices for Mastery and Well-Being. Dr. Birkelhammer, is there a website for you or for the book that people can access?
Yeah, go to www.larrybirkelhammer.com.
Okay, that's easy enough. It's LarryBirkelhammer.com.
Yeah, that's
all right.
Great.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And folks, thank you for listening to this edition to Mind Talk. Remember, you can listen to this program again and to all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional of your choosing. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26 by 2 Communications. The assistant to the executive producer is Lede Battle. For more information about Mind Talk, please go to mindtalk.org. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And folks, you remember, if it is unacceptable, then that is exactly, precisely what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.